Western countries. It is also resisting to increased demands of some of the JCPOA parties.
According to an economist, Hashem Khani, only two support programs implemented in Iran in recent decades have been successful in reducing inequality after all. Those are direct cash subsidies and offering education and health services to disenfranchised areas.
Hearing that economist, it should be a fairly smooth program because the government will have the money for the cash subsidies program. And so prices will not have to experience a further sudden hike as a result.
Now, Iran's problems aren't isolated incidents. Question is, has or will the global threat to food security following Ukraine's invasion by Russia affect Iran's budget deficit, inflation and hiked food prices?
Of course, the international food price has increased, but not to the rate that we are talking about. The international price must have increased some. I'm not up to date, of course, I must confess, but I don't expect that the price of wheat in the world has doubled. No, it's a small percentage has increased.
Of course, it affects prices in Iran. It is a reality that because of the drought and also the war between Russia and Ukraine, given the fact that these two countries are major producers of oil seeds in the world, the prices of wheat and cereal have doubled compared to last year, from $250 for each ton to $500.
According to the Plan and Budget Organization, Iran annually spends 9 quadrillion rials on subsidizing food, medicine, and an array of services. Now, still imagining two separate exchange rates, that would be over $31.5 billion at the market rate, or $214 billion at the official rate.
We can allocate the open market rate to products like white meat and cooking oil and pay people the difference between the 42,000 real currency rate and the open market rate as direct cash handouts. There are some benefits to this policy. First, this policy will provide grounds for domestic producers to produce oil seeds, livestock inputs, and wheat. Second, it would prevent important raw materials for products like biscuits, spaghetti, white meat, and medicine to be exported to other countries. Third, the country's potential production capacities will be activated.
The government appears confident the economy has weathered its most difficult days. That's partly down to Iran's diversified economy and non-oil exports to regional countries.
That'll be it for today. Thanks from the whole team. But remember, the story is progressive. So to see how Iran is progressing with matters economic and otherwise, do tune in again at the same times next week and each week after. Bye for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Path towards enlightenment.
In the name of God, the All-Compassionate, the All-Merciful. Salam and welcome to another episode of our weekly series titled Path Towards Enlightenment, which is an endeavor to make you and us familiar with an easy and fluent explanation of God's final scripture to all mankind, the Noble Quran, that was revealed to the last and greatest of all messengers, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. As you know, last week, we completed the explanation of Surah Ar-Rahman, and from this Friday onwards, we embark on explanation of the next surah, that is Surah Waqi'ah, which is number 56 in the serial order of compilation of the Noble Quran. It has 96 ayahs and was revealed in Mecca. It takes its name from ayah 1, which mentions Al-Waqi'ah, that is, the imminent hour or the inevitable event to occur at the end of time. It is the day of resurrection followed by the final judgment, which the disbelievers deny. When it occurs, all false notions entertained by the doubters about its happening shall vanish and its reality shall penetrate every soul, since there will be no question any more of its denial. On the day of judgment, there will be sorting out of good and evil. People will be divided into three classes: those brought near to the divine threshold for having reached the highest degree of faith, those on the right or ordinary believers who made mistakes but turned in repentance to Allah and thereafter lived a pious life, and those on the left, that is, the disbelievers, who denied God's message and the prophets, lived in sins, and died in the state of disbelief. Ample proof is given in this surah of the infinite power of the Almighty Creator, and consequently his ability to bring about the resurrection. As for the benefits of reciting this surah, and of course through contemplation on the message of its ayahs, a hadith from the Prophet says that such a person will neither be from among the absent-minded nor will be afflicted with poverty. Other hadith on the authority of the Prophet's infallible successors say, the regular reciter of Surah Waqi'ah will be listed among the loyal companions of Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace upon him, will have a radiant face on the day of resurrection, will be able to resolve his or her problems during lifetime, and will be respected in society. It is also narrated that reciting this surah on a dead believer results in forgiveness of the deceased, while its recitation on a person on deathbed will make him or her die with ease. Let us start with ayahs 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6 of Surah Waqi'ah.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Idha waqa'atil waqi'ah, laysa li waqa'atiha kadhiba, khafidatur rafi'ah. Idha rujjatil ardu rajja, وبست الجبال بسا فكانت هباء منبثا.
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful, when the imminent hour befalls, there is no denying that it will befall. It will be lowering, exalting. When the earth is shaken violently, and the mountains are shattered into bits, and become scattered dust. Resurrection is denied by the disbelievers as something improbable, as well as by some persons of weak faith because of different motives, even if they believe in the beginning of creation. These ayahs thus focus on the inevitability of the day of resurrection, preceded by shocking events whose manifestations shall be reflected in all elements of the world of nature. This, however, will not benefit the disbelievers and deniers who happen to witness it, since their fate is already sealed. Resurrection makes alterations in both the physical world and the status of mankind by lowering some and elevating some others. In other words, there will be a sorting out of good and evil. When the disbelievers, even if they were mighty and influential in the mortal world, rendered low, while the believers, irrespective of their social status during lifetime, exalted to high ranks and degrees. Ayahs 5 and 6 mean to say that the earthquake shall be so enormous that it shall pulverize mountains into scattered dust particles. These ayahs are a warning to us to refrain from disbelief and sins by living a virtuous life in obedience to divine commandments, so as to be safe from the horrible consequences and torments of that fateful day. From these ayahs, we'll learn that, number one, resurrection and the final judgments will definitely occur, and denying these realities is detrimental to the faithless and the disbelievers. Number two, the day of resurrection will usher in a different physical world where all will gather and judged according to their deeds. With the disbelievers and unrepentant sinners tasting the horrors of hell, and the believers rewarded the bliss of paradise. And number three, resurrection will be preceded by earthquakes whose intensity will shatter mighty mountains into pieces. Now we invite you to listen to ayahs 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, and 14 of the same surah.
وَكُنْتُمْ أَزْوَاجًا ثَلَاثَةً فَأَصْحَابُ الْمَيْمَنَةِ مَا أَصْحَابُ الْمَيْمَنَةِ وَأَصْحَابُ الْمَشْأَمَةِ مَا أَصْحَابُ الْمَشْأَمَةِ والسابقون السابقون أولئك المقربون في جنات النعيم ثلة من الأولين وقليل من الآخرين.
You will be divided into three groups on that day. The people of the right hand. And what are the people of the right hand, and the people of the left hand, and what are the people of the left hand? And the foremost ones are the foremost ones. They are the ones brought nearest to Allah, to reside in the gardens of bliss. A multitude from the former generations, that is, from the communities of the prophets of the past, and a few from the latter ones. These ayahs categorize people in three groups. The first are those whose record of deeds is given in their right hand to indicate their success in achieving the reward of paradise. Since they were righteous in belief, did good deeds, abstained from sins, and if any mistake had occurred, they repented of their misdeed, sought forgiveness, and returned to divine grace. The second group is made up of those whose record of deeds is given in their left hand to indicate their utmost misery and the punishment of hell for having lived an unrepentant life of sins and disobedience of divine commandments. The third is the best of the three groups and is placed nearest to the divine threshold for being persons of firm and unflinching faith whose whole life was devoted to the cause of God and guidance of mankind, for whom they served as role models, even if it meant offering themselves a sacrifice for promotion of faith and humanitarian values in society. They are thus referred here as sabiqun, or the foremost, and muqarrabun, or the nearest ones to God Almighty, who is far glorious to have any form or place. They will thus have the highest station in paradise. The ranks of the foremost include the prophets, their legatees, their loyal companions, and of course, the infallible imams and their confidants. Many of them will be from between the time of the father of the human race, Adam, and the generation of the last and greatest messenger, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. A few of the foremost will be from the later generations. From these ayahs, we'll learn that, number one, resurrection will make manifest the truly prosperous persons and the really miserable ones, irrespective of the status they had in society while alive. Number two, paradise is for the persons of true belief, including those who had sincerely repented of their misdeeds and earned forgiveness from God, while hell is for the disbelievers, the heretics, the tyrants, the misleaders of people, and the unrepentant sinners. And number three, pride of place in the highest echelons of paradise is for the foremost in belief and deeds. In conclusion of this week's episode of Path Towards Enlightenment, we present you ayahs 15, 16, 17, 18, and 19 of Surah Waqi'ah.
عَلَى سُرُرٍ مَوْضُونَةٍ مُتَّكِئِينَ عَلَيْهَا مُتَقَابِلِينَ يَطُوفُ عَلَيْهِمْ وِلْدَانٌ مُخَلَّدُونَ بأكواب وأباريق وكأس من معين لا يصدعون عنها ولا ينزفون.
On brocaded couches, reclining on them face to face, they will be served by youth of perpetual freshness. With goblets and ewers and a cup of a pure drink, which neither causes them headache nor a stupefaction. These ayahs depict some of the unimaginable blessings granted by God in the higher echelons of paradise to the foremost of faith and deeds, such as reclining on couches of the finest brocade and conversing with each other without being the least bored, while being served by youthful boys of perpetual freshness with goblets and ewers filled with the most delicious drinks, flavored with camphor and ginger, that neither cause any headache nor dizziness. From these ayahs, we learn the following points. Number one, the people in paradise recline on the most splendid couches and enjoy each other's company in pleasant settings without being the least bored. And number two, the foods and drinks of paradise, unlike those of our world, are pristinely pure without any side effects.
Say to America is be true to what you said on paper.
We won't back down.
Stop the witch hunt.
Turn here now.
We will resist.
I can't breathe. Help me. Please.
We the people.
Another massacre has put the American nation in another state of panic, this time in Texas. An 18-year-old gunman decided to make a bloodbath in a school in Uvalde. He managed to terminate the lives of 19 children and two teachers amid a slow response from police present at the scene. Children inside Robb Elementary School classrooms 111 and 112 repeatedly called for 911 and pleaded for help from authorities, but to no avail. The pro-gun faction's argument in America is that people with weapons could use them to save lives, but in reality, not even police managed to rescue the young children's lives in the presence of a savage shooter.
Uvalde carnage.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to We the People. I'm your host, Daniel Arya. This episode is dedicated to the victims of a deadly school shooting in Uvalde, Texas. We'll investigate the mass shooting and the general rise of violence in America, coupled with easy access to guns and police inaction. Most of the politicians are either ignoring the situation or abusing it in favor of their own interests. As any other phenomena in America, this one is also turning into a power play between liberals and conservatives. In this episode, we'll be joined by Karanja Keita Carroll, faculty member in the Department of Black and Latino Studies at Baruch College, CUNY. His teaching and research interests revolve around African-centered theory and methodology with an emphasis on social and psychological theory. And later in the program, we'll be joined by Rahul Mankata, international law and civil rights attorney out of New York, to get his take on the issue. Please stay tuned.
And in the last 10 days, we've had elderly black people killed in a supermarket in Buffalo. We've had Asian churchgoers killed in Southern California. And now we have children murdered at school. When are we going to do something? I'm tired of the moments of silence. Enough.
The U.S. police is notorious for brutality against protesters and racial minorities. However, in the latest mass shooting, their inaction is what has wreaked havoc. There were nearly 20 law enforcement officers standing in a hallway outside the classroom, and they all failed to take any action as they waited for room keys and tactical equipment to arrive first. The gunman was therefore allowed to get engaged in the atrocity for around one full hour without any real reaction from the cops.
In any country, police are supposed to be ready to sacrifice their own lives in order to save those of children. That obviously did not happen in this mass shooting. American authorities have failed to take any action in the face of repeated mass shootings in the United States. So what are the people to do?
I believe the people, number one, need to become organized. And by them becoming organized, that means that they are a collective that understands what the nature of the problem is and how they go about fixing it. I do not believe that the authorities nor the government will have the answers to fix these random mass shootings and the rampant gun violence within the nation at this point. It is necessary for communities to come together. I am not anti-gun. I am anti-gun violence, but I'm not anti-gun. Arguably, guns do not kill people. People kill people. So it is about people becoming organized and educated that will allow for these issues to decrease.
The slow response has outraged the victims' families, who are demanding action to be taken against the irresponsible police. They have also come face-to-face with the dark reality of deadly weapons and how accessible they are to the youth in the United States. Some of the cops present at the scene reportedly saved their own children from the school and ignored others.
I would argue it's going to be the continued co-option of elected officials. It is going to be business as usual. I don't believe anything will change. I actually think that when incidents like this happen, the gun lobby gets even more powerful because they're trying to get what they believe they've lost due to these type of incidents. Excuse me.
Now the official story of the school shooting keeps changing, but the parents waiting outside were allegedly threatened with arrest. One cop even brandished a taser gun to stop a parent from attempts to save their own kids themselves. So how can parents make sure that their children do not fall victim to these mass shootings in schools, which have been rather common in recent years?
That's a great question, too, and I thought about that. I think that we're living in an age of such great technology and high technology that I think would be very conceivable to, if you really need to have a gun culture, to install sort of the equipment to detect weapons, detect guns that you have in, say, airports or other areas of high, security, weapons or gun technology that can detect weapons in school settings. I don't think it would be very expensive to install. That might be the first option, improving technology so that, you could have a school zone and a radius wherein weapons are absolutely not able to be either smuggled in or entered into a school area, just like an airport or any other, federal or governmental building.
Now, the Uvalde school shooting is indeed going to erode trust in police even further. Trust has already lessened after incidents like the murder of George Floyd by a white cop, weakening any incentives for people to cooperate with law enforcement.
Most law enforcement agencies, because of factors including a culture of machismo and a number of legal restraints, do little or no mental health screening for cops when returning from military deployment, and provide little in the way of treatment. And finally, the hiring preferences for former service members that tend to benefit whites disproportionately make it harder to build police forces that resemble and understand diverse communities. So I think that it is the relationship between the military industrial complex and police departments that needs to be understood before or and as we begin to look at what is taking place within these mass shootings.
With police opting not to pursue the shooter into the classroom, there seems to be no way to explain to the parents why and how they lost their children. The U.S. mainstream media is also struggling to find ways to defend police. In reality, neither the Constitution nor state law impose any duty upon police officers or other governmental officials to protect individuals from harm. What is the root cause of violence in America and the urges for savagery to arise in shooters such as Salvador Ramos?
The origins or the roots is connected to the very history of this nation. The very history of the United States is rooted in violence from the European colonizers who came here and attempted to strip the land from the indigenous people, from the forced labor that they brought from Africans, from the economic system, from issues of racism, sexism, all of them, they are violent in their origin and they are foundational to the United States of America. So the root cause of this is violence within American culture. And this is why I believe that education is essential, is necessary for people to understand and become conscious of the very nature, historical, social historical history within this nation in order to stop and prevent and begin to challenge manifestations of violence such as this. But I think that violence is at the very foundation of this nation.
The recent school shooting is yet another tragic event added to the long list of school shootings in U.S. history in which innocent children are killed by a deranged shooter. Behind such bloodbath is a labyrinth of power that takes immense profit from the sale of weapons and ammunition.
The Second Amendment is very, very well entrenched into the United States. Obviously, it's the Second Amendment right after the First. So there'll be definitely a hell of a fight. But I think that there's probably an issue with mass populated areas, which have a much greater chance of the American people mobilizing to curtail or ban automatic weapons. The issue is in rural areas. That's really where you have the sort of the Bible Belt. They really hold on to their weapons, and it's sort of like more the frontier mentality over there in the rural areas.
Entities such as the NRA, that's the National Rifle Association, backed by powerful conservative politicians, unabashedly promote the idea of carrying and selling guns, disregarding the gruesome series of mass killings in America. So what is next for powerful pro-gun entities such as the NRA amid brutal shootings such as this recent one we saw in Uvalde, Texas?
Well, recently New York Attorney General, I think, almost drove them out of New York, where their headquarters used to be ancient times. When I say ancient times, I mean since the time of the founding of the NRA in the United States, they always had a headquarters in New York, or at least a major place of business. And Letitia James sort of drove them out when she asked for depositions, and she filed a lawsuit and wanted to go through their books, things of that nature. And they just said, we're just going to leave New York and go to Texas. And I think they declared bankruptcy as well. I believe they did. So they've been chased out of New York. So. In terms of lobbying power, that's really Texas is obviously friendly territory, which is why what happened this weekend, this past week, is such a shock, because it took place in Texas, which is a really big stronghold of the Second Amendment, the Fifth Circuit as well, the district courts there, probably the strongest gun culture in the United States.
Identified as Salvador Ronaldo Ramos, the shooter easily bought two rifles and hundreds of rounds of ammunition to shoot his grandmother in the face before storming Robb Elementary School. As long as guns are so available, there seems to be no real end in sight for carnage emanating from various reasons, such as racism or mental problems.
The military-industrial complex is integrally involved in the United States, as well as the national security apparatus. That's not really a secret, and unfortunately dictates much of the United States' domestic and foreign policy, unfortunately. It's sort of a death culture, and that goes all the way to the national security apparatus. The military-industrial complex is very, very heavily involved. Also, in you know, for example, with big tech in the United States, which is another problem. I mean, the entire world has sort of pared big tech down a lot with antitrust enforcement. The European Union, Margaret Vestager, for example, and Russian Federation, and a lot of European countries sort of went after big tech, Google, you know. But the United States, unfortunately, big tech is their big advantage.
Republican proponents of the so-called Second Amendment of the U.S. Constitution keep promoting the idea of having free and unchecked access to deadly weapons while reaping profits from the business by military-industrial complex. What role does America's military-industrial complex play in the victimization of innocent lives lost in mass shootings?
There are a couple things that need to be understood. On one hand, it is, yes, those perpetrating the crime of these mass shootings, but it's also the law enforcement and how they are actually acting and responding in relation to these mass shootings. We should recognize that roughly 19% of police officers are veterans. Okay, when we have officers coming back completing military service with potential post-traumatic stress, it creates a different type of officer. And, you know, there's a report that came out from the Marshall Project entitled When Warriors Wear Badges, and their conclusions about veteran cops kind of tell us the relationship between the military-industrial complex and what's going on with these mass shootings. These are some of the conclusions that they came to. They said that veterans who work as police are more vulnerable to self-destructive behavior, alcohol abuse, drugs, et cetera, even attempted suicide.
And now even on the left, people in power have refused to take any real action. Therefore, obtaining guns remains an easy task that could be exploited by those trying to terrorize the fabric of U.S. society. U.S. authorities need to retain the public trust in the wake of these many mass shootings.
There's a spiritual dearth in the United States. I think that value systems have eroded. I think the replacement of God or decency in the schools with Luciferian ideals, with man-made ideals, to replace, spiritual ideals of family and nuclear families, for example. I think that video games, certainly the gun culture, violence in the movies, violence in television, has desensitized people from birth, childhood, all the way to adulthood in this country for decades, where the value of human life is not as respected as they are in other cultures and other countries.
That is probably the most important measure in order to make America look safer than it actually is. This way, they might be able to compromise for the drawback of policing, particularly in the more marginalized communities. What changes need to be made to the U.S. gun laws in an effort to prevent mass shootings and gun violence?
This is a case of a nation of two cities, a tale of two cities. In the urban areas of America, there is no question that automatic weapons and should be considered weapons of mass destruction and treated as such. One lunatic with one weapon can murder so many people. That's why it's absolutely not something that the founding fathers probably envisioned. So there has to be, in major cities, there has to be completely different gun laws than the rest of the United States. I think that's the only way to balance the equation. Unfortunately, like I said, the Second Amendment is so well entrenched in the United States that it's almost as vigorously enforced and supported as the First Amendment is. First and Second are obviously the most important. So, but again, you know, the Founding Fathers did not envision a major single.
Thousands of people die every year from gun violence as more people keep hoarding more and more firearms. The gun business in the U.S. is controlled by powerful lobbies who won't allow gun control laws to pass against their profits. From professional criminals to normal people beside themselves, guns could provide the illusion of a go-to solution to deal with the conflict at hand.
I don't necessarily think that any type of legal changes will do anything of any significance. I argue that, you know, the fundamental change is an educational change. Just as people need to be organized and aware and conscious, people need to be educated on the nature of gun safety, gun violence, and, you know, when to and when not to utilize firearms, you know. I don't think that, you know, I'll make a comparison to the Civil Rights Movement. In the Civil Rights Movement, the argument was that, you know, it is going to be illegal to be racist or do anything against folks of color. The laws put it on the books, but it still happened. So I don't necessarily think that new gun laws are going to change anything in regards to mass shootings and gun violence.
Committing crimes such as homicide, which is murder, are easier in the U.S. with broken laws providing access to guns for most people. Gun violence, murders, and gang activity all involve getting hold of a gun, and in the U.S., that's truly a piece of cake. And now it's time we see what Abbas Motarim has prepared for us this week.
Last segment of Power to the People, I spoke about the mass shooting in Buffalo by a neo-Nazi white supremacist that left 10 black people dead. I ended the segment talking about how the sad part about these shootings is that they will continue to happen until the violence of American settler colonialism and imperialism ends. And literally not even a week after I recorded the last segment, another tragic mass shooting happened. And this time, it was in Texas and at a school, which left 19 children dead and two adults dead as well. And while this mass shooter wasn't a self-proclaimed neo-Nazi like the Buffalo shooter, the fact of the matter is that white supremacist capitalist imperialism is still to blame, as these mass shootings are merely a byproduct of this violent American society. On this episode of Power to the People, we will get to the root of the issue of mass shootings, which is settler colonial violence. As Imam Jamil al-Amin once said, violence is as American as cherry pie. And we must understand that a state that is founded on the genocide of indigenous and African people, as well as the enslavement of Africans, will always be violent. America itself is literally the biggest purveyor of violence in the world. From wars, to CIA coups, to chemical warfare, to using nuclear bombs. So it should be to no surprise that there's also constant violence within the belly of the beast. Mass shootings in America, they're a byproduct of America's colonial violence. And if we trace the history of guns in America, it's due to Europeans and the colonization of Africa and the start of the transatlantic slave trade. Europeans used guns to conquer the land and to steal Africans. And then these Europeans, they used guns to form a settler colony in America. Guns were used in order to protect these newly founded European colonies in America. And the so-called United States Constitution, through the Second Amendment, legalized the right for the masses of white European settlers to own guns in order to protect their property, which was enslaved Africans and stolen land. The Second Amendment of the Constitution says, quote, a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Literally, the roots of the Second Amendment is in the protection of the Euro-American slave-holding class as well as their property. And literally, every white settler was armed to protect this power structure, whether they owned slaves, land, or anything else. And this is why there's millions upon millions of guns in the street today. And this is the history. And it just shows that American culture is a culture of violence. American gun culture is just a product of settler colonialism and imperialism, and mass shootings are too. But time and time again, after mass shootings, Democrats, or even people, you know, who call themselves progressives, even though they're not, they advocate for gun control. And gun control itself is inherently racist, as it has been a means to keep guns out of the hands of black and other colonized people. Shoot, even the Second Amendment, itself was a form of gun control, as it was only legal for settlers, aka Euro-Americans, to have guns. And the people who advocate for gun control, they aren't truly about gun control, because in their so-called advocacy to take guns out of the street, by default, it means that guns should only be in the hands of the state. And America itself is the biggest purveyor of violence, not only at home, but across the world. Literally, America is the biggest arms dealer in the world. Again, this literally shows the contradiction of those who want gun control. So if you truly want to end these mass shootings, you would want to end American settler colonialism and imperialism, because this is what's at the root of these mass shootings. This is power to the people.
Thank you for watching the program with us, everyone. Let's pray for families that lost loved ones in this horrible mass shooting at the school, hoping that such incidents do not occur again. I'm your host, Daniel Arya. Please join me next week with another episode of We the People. Goodbye for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Ayatollah Khamenei elaborates on six key points of Imam Khomeini's testament. June 4, 2018. Most of Iran consists of a youthful population born after Imam Khomeini's blessed life had ended. They were either born after he passed away or with young children at that time. But these faithful youth, living in various parts of the country, loved Imam and his memory so much that it's as if they had been in this company all along. As we say in Samad supplication, we rightly and sincerely put our faith in him without being able to see him. They enjoyed pure and sincere faith without having been born during the Imam's lifetime and without having the opportunity to listen to his remarks. This is not peculiar to our nation alone. In many parts of the world, as well as in Muslim countries, people have the same feeling towards Imam Khomeini. This reality is the result of two factors. One is the greatness of the Imam and the various aspects of this personality, which was unparalleled in recent and contemporary years. The other factor is the greatness of this revolution.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
It is the greatness of a deed that our magnanimous Imam accomplished in the present era by relying on his faith, acumen, and a strong determination. This deed was his initiation of the Islamic Revolution and the establishment of the Islamic Republic. The greatness of this revolution is indicative of our magnanimous Imam's greatness. Iran's revolution was a divine miracle. Imam Khomeini, rahmatullah alayhi, left a perpetual guideline for his ummah, our nation, with his words and deeds, meaning that the words of Imam Khomeini, rahmatullah alayhi, guide us through all difficult stages of life. And his testament is one of the best and most influential moral legacies of his time. It is advisable that the people, the different officials, and all youth refer to his statement at different times and reflect on it. Let me refer to some of the points mentioned in Imam Khomeini's testament, which is full of useful meaning. The first point is that Imam Khomeini, rahmatullah alayhi, insisted in his testament on the fact that the Islamic revolution is a divine revolution, and it is mainly based on the will of the people. The Islamic revolution belongs to the people. This means that no individual, social class, or group can and should claim to be the owner of this revolution and consider others as a subsidiary.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong.
Of Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
We're on our way to the front line, outside the key Ukrainian stronghold of Adievka. We pull up by the side of the road. It feels like no man's land.
The town is fortified well, but we're working on them, dismantling their dugouts with artillery. We're making passages in their defenses and going deeper. You can hear our volleys now.
Now, it's too dangerous to take the car along this road as it can be a target for anti-tank missiles fired from the Ukrainians, who are just about a kilometer in that direction, so we're going on foot.
These fighters are from the Donbas, now loyal to Russia. They've been fighting here against Ukrainian nationalists for 8 years. Trench warfare has returned once again to Europe. While some of the world's most advanced weapons are slaughtering dozens of soldiers every day, the best defense remains underground. The living quarters, It's infested with kittens. The soldiers tell me that they have them at every outpost. They bring good luck, they say. More likely, much-needed comfort in this brutal war.
Now, Adyevka is just over in that direction there. It's so well fortified that risking a frontal attack would cost so many lives, or indeed may not even be possible. That's why the Russian army is trying to encircle the Ukrainian army to the north of here. And then, after it does that, if it's able to do that, they plan to come down here and take Adyevka. Because to take Donbass, the whole of Donbass, it's major fortifications like this, which will have to be taken as well.
The remains of mortar shells. The trenches are doing their job. It's been some time since Russia has released its casualty figures, perhaps because the number might be hard for Russian people to swallow. But it's clear, with overwhelming air and artillery superiority, Russia is winning this war, where the fighting is fiercest. The next outpost, as promised, more kittens. Russian soldiers are being dehumanized by Ukrainian propaganda as monsters and orcs, leading to atrocities committed against Russian POWs. But it's clear these soldiers are very human indeed. Upon hearing I was British, one of the soldiers appealed to me to tell the truth about what was happening here to people back in the UK. I asked him what that truth was.
That there's a genocide of the Russian-speaking population going on here. The Ukrainians have been shelling our people for 8 years. They are trying to extinguish us. Tell them about this at least. At any moment, I can die here, but I am on my land and I will fight for it.
No doubt the Ukrainian soldiers in their trenches across the fields will have a very different version of the truth. Compromise is being achieved through war. Appropriately for this European conflict, poppies grow in the trenches. Many years from now, perhaps soldiers from both sides will be able to commemorate their fallen comrades together. But for now, the battle for the Donbass rages on. Jenny Miller, Donbass.
The majority of the EU's 705 legislators do support the 27-nation bloc's handling of the Ukraine conflict, but a growing minority are very unhappy. On the issue of sanctions, the EU has been accused of double standards and hypocrisy.
C'est que quand la Russie attaque...
If Russia attacks Ukraine, there will be sanctions. When the US bombs Iraq, no sanctions. When Saudi Arabia bombs Yemen, no sanctions. When the EU destroys Libya, no sanctions. When Israel colonizes Palestine, no sanctions.
When dissenting voices in the European Parliament highlight Ukraine's history of corruption or the need for greater diplomatic efforts with Russia, they are often shut down.
Please, dear colleagues, try to do preventive diplomacy. As somebody who has gone through
you
the
have
war,
to come to
I know that war does not resolve anything. Thank you.
Mainly due to the conflict, energy and food prices continue to soar in the EU, placing enormous financial hardship on citizens. Despite this, it seems the focus remains fixed on weapons.
Our unprecedented military support package of 2 billion euros under the European peace facility helps Ukraine defend its population.
Some analysts blame NATO and the EU, directed by the United States, for provoking Russia into military action.
And now, for Ukraine, it's a very bad situation. For Russia also, and for Europe, it's a very bad situation.
Any of the 27 leaders in the EU can veto key policies in the European Council. For example, Hungary has been blocking a total ban on Russian oil imports. Some lawmakers want the veto option to be scrapped.
For 1 month, we put our indecisiveness out on full display. And what was the outcome? The perception that one member state won and the EU as a collective lost.
Other lawmakers disagree. They say it would be yet another example of the EU moving away from being a peace project and towards becoming a federalist superpower to benefit big business, including the arms industry. Jerome Hughes at the European Parliament, Brussels.
The UK has marked the Queen's Platinum Jubilee. The royal family paraded the capital over the long bank holiday weekend, and Transport for London finally opened the long-awaited Elizabeth line. But strikes put a damper on things, with members of the Rail, Maritime and Transport Union, desperate for better pay, walked off the job. Rose works for TfL. After a long day on the picket line, she spoke at the People's Assembly. The cost of living crisis has hit hard, but who will bear the brunt?
This is affecting all working people of all different types in all parts of the country, and that means that we do have to come together. We do need to recognise that we are in this fight together.
The government must act. It must act to make sure that children aren't hungry. It must act to make sure that people don't lose their homes. It must act so that people can go on holiday. That's an important thing as well, and we're going to lose all of that across the next few months unless the government changes course.
The speaker